Strangely enough, a section from Jeremiah to begin with. Jeremiah lived over 100 years after Micah, but when he found himself up against it, it was Micah's words that came to his rescue. So we're going to just look at Jeremiah. I'll read it, you follow. The Lord said to me, "Stand in the court of the temple and proclaim all I've commanded you to say to the people who come from the towns of Judah. Don't leave out anything. Perhaps the people will listen and give up their evil ways. If they do, then I will change my mind about the destruction I plan to bring on them all for their wicked deeds." The Lord told me to say to the people, "I, the Lord, have said that you must obey me by following the teaching that I gave you, and by paying attention to the words of my servants, the prophets, whom I have kept on sending to you. You have never obeyed what they said, but if you continue to disobey, then I will do to this temple what I did to Shiloh, and all the nations of the world will use the name of this city as a curse." The priests, the prophets, and all the people heard me saying these things in the temple, and as soon as I had finished all that the Lord had commanded me to speak, they grabbed me and shouted, "You ought to be killed for this. Why have you said in the Lord's name that this temple will become like Shiloh and that this city will be destroyed and no one will live in it?" Then the people crowded around me. When the leaders of Judah heard what had happened, they hurried from the royal palace to the temple and took their places at the new gate. Then the priests and the prophets said to the leaders and to the people, "This man deserves to be sentenced to death because he has spoken against our city. You heard him with your own ears." Then I said, "The Lord sent me to proclaim everything that you heard me say against this temple and against this city. You must change the way you are living. If you do, he will not destroy the city. As for me, I am in your power. Do with me whatever you think is fair and right. But be sure of this. If you kill me, you will be guilty of killing an innocent man, because it is the Lord who sent me to give you this warning." After that, some of the elders stood up and said to the people who had gathered, "When Hezekiah was king of Judah, the prophet Micah of Moresheth told all the people, 'Zion will be ploughed like a field. Jerusalem will become a pile of ruins. The temple hill will become a forest.' King Hezekiah and the people of Judah did not put Micah to death. Instead, Hezekiah honored the Lord and tried to win his favor, and the Lord changed his mind about the disaster that he said he would bring on them. Now we're about to bring a terrible disaster on ourselves." So Micah comes before Jeremiah in the scheme of things. Micah belongs to that period when the northern kingdom fell to Assyria, and Jeremiah to that period about 120 or 30 years later when the southern kingdom of Judah fell to Babylon. And we just have a few words that we thought about earlier from Micah 6. "What should I bring to pay homage to the Lord? Should I bring burnt offerings with year-old calves to sacrifice? Would he be pleased by thousands of sacrificial rams or 10,000 swollen rivers of sweet olive oil? Should I offer my oldest son for my wrongdoing, the child of my body, to cover the sins of my life?" Carry on. "No, he has told you, mortals, what is good in his sight. What else does the Lord ask of you but to live justly, to love kindness, and to walk humbly with your God?" Now, I think this prophet is best known for three things. Firstly, the words we read together at the very start of the service. "He will judge between nations and will settle disputes. They will beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation will not take up sword against nation, nor will they train for war anymore." Beautiful, beautiful words. Also, very similar words in Isaiah chapter 2. Do you remember the hippie movement? Well, you probably don't, but some of us will remember the hippie movement of the 1960s. Flower power, as they used to say. Make love, not war. And do you remember John Lennon's powerful lyrics that captured the mood of a generation? "Imagine there's no countries. It isn't hard to do. Nothing to kill or die for, and no religion too. Imagine all the people living life in peace. You may say I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. I hope someday you'll join us and the world will be as one. Imagine no possessions, I wonder if you can. No need for greed or hunger, a brotherhood of man. Imagine all the people sharing all the world. You may say I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. I hope someday you'll join us and the world will be as one. A period of history in which there was a great deal of hope, I think, at the end of the 60s and into the early 70s, that somehow the world would change for the better. And the Bible also paints such a picture here in Micah chapter 4, not the result, however, of human evolution, but the result, ultimately, of divine intervention. One day, Jesus will return. Second thing the book is known for is the reference to Bethlehem that we read every Christmas. It's there in chapter 5, verse 2. Bethlehem, Ephrathah, you are one of the smallest towns in Judah, but out of you I will bring a ruler for Israel whose family line goes back to ancient times. Now, there's something in this verse that we give little thought to when we read it every Christmas. The Messiah would come from a village on the outskirts of the big city, Jerusalem. And in fact, Micah the prophet also came from a small village, Moresheth, very close to Bethlehem. And all the bad stuff that was going on in the cities of Jerusalem and Samaria when Micah was speaking, he drew the city life into focus. Religious life was set upon Shiloh in the north and Jerusalem in the south. But God chose prophets from villages to bring a sense of perspective to his people. Years ago, and I think I've told you this before, I remember reading an article by a man who ran a Christian paper in the city somewhere in America, and how he'd gone out to visit his in-laws in the countryside. His father-in-law was a farmer out there, and they were discussing the difference between city life and country life. And eventually the father-in-law settled on this. He said, I think the thing about city life is that you guys in the city expect everything to get better every year. You expect promotion in your jobs, you expect a higher wage, you expect a better car, you expect to get nicer things in your house. You sometimes somehow expect improvement all the time. But when you're a farmer in the country, you don't know what each year will bring. Sometimes there's good weather, there's a good harvest, but sometimes there's drought. Sometimes there's a deluge that washes your crops away. You pray that things will be okay, but you know that from year to year, it will not always be constant increase. Now, that wasn't a particular beef of the prophets, but there was this contrast between village and city going on. The cities have become absorbed with buildings and temples and ritual and had lost sight of what God really wanted. And when you were in the village where you had none of these props, you then had a deeper sense of the inner life that God was after from you. Which brings me, thirdly, to the famous words that we've just read from Micah chapter 6. He has told you what is good. What else does the Lord ask of you but to live justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God? So let me reflect on each of these three things. To live justly. Now, it's pretty obvious that the world is not a just place. Where you are born will determine a whole lot of things about your prospects in life. 20 years ago, I don't think we even used the phrase human trafficking, but now it's commonplace. Week after week, we see women in the food bank who have, and the technical phrase is, no recourse to public funds. If they're lucky, they may get a card from the government charged up with £37.50 a week with which to manage the whole of their lives. The Daily Mail, if you read it, will probably tell you that they're scroungers, but there are some very sad stories that I've come across of domestic abuse etched across many of their faces. The truth is much more complex than sometimes the newspapers tell you. And the truth is that life is unfair for people. I recently went to a meeting in Forest Gate where we're having a look at what provision there is for homeless people in the area. And we got around to talking about night shelters. And because night shelters are run by volunteers, they try to screen out the awkward people because they don't feel that volunteers are equipped to deal with them. So when you apply to go in a night shelter, if you have a drug problem or have had one in the last 6 months, if you have an alcohol problem or have had one in the last 6 months, or if you have a mental health problem, we don't want you in the night shelters because you'll give us problems that our volunteers can't be expected to cope with. And so I constantly come across people that I can't refer to the night shelter because I know they'll get turned down. Same goes to the homeless hostels. The same kind of filtering goes on. Now, in former generations, we tended to interpret these words about acting justly as meaning that we should live morally upright lives. But as the world has become a smaller place, we've begun to realise that God looks for more from us. An old friend of mine once did a word study on poverty in the Bible. He looked up every single reference to the poor and poverty that he could find. And he went into it thinking the reason that people are poor is because they're idle. They don't work hard enough. What he found when he looked through the Bible was that 2/3 of the references to poverty were linked with oppression. To live justly is to do something about the injustice, to make life better for others, to campaign when the system itself is unfair. I found out something interesting this week. Keir Hardie, who was the founder of the Labour Party, who was born back in the 1850s and died in 1915, he was the MP for West Ham. Did you know that? This constituency. The first time he stood as an MP in 1892, he stood here in West Ham and won a place. He was one of only two Labour MPs that got seats in Parliament at that time. If you look back through his story, his mum was a single parent. His dad was not interested in him. At 8, he was a baker's delivery boy. At 11, he was working in the coal mines. By the age of 17, however, his mother had worked with him and taught him to read and to write. And then later on, at the age of 36, he was elected as the independent Labour Party candidate here in West Ham. And during his first few years in Parliament, the first day he turned up in Parliament, he wore a tweed suit. That wasn't the way you dressed in the 1890s in Parliament. And he also wore a deer stalker, you know, a Sherlock Holmes hat on his head. And whenever he got up to speak, the issues that he was championing were women's rights, free schooling, free state pensions, and Indian self-rule. When Edward VIII, who was to become the son of Victoria, who would become Edward VIII, when he was born, he was heavily criticised because in Parliament that day, when everybody was bandying out congratulations to the royal family, he was the one who drew attention instead to a mining disaster in Wales. And because of the way that he did that, they reckoned that he wasn't voted back in again. He did, however, get back into Parliament. He died at the age of 59, having founded the Labour Party. He was virtually penniless when he died, and his passing was not even acknowledged by the House of Commons. But in my view, he had lived justly. He had lived a proactive life to make this world a better place for those who were the victims of injustice. To love mercy. Mercy in the context is another word for kindness. That's why we picked up the word kindness earlier. If living justly is about addressing the faults in the system, then loving mercy is about doing something practical in the here and now, while the system is being mended. And you can't help but notice that Jesus spent so much of his time just picking up the problems of ordinary people. His healing ministry was such a major part of what he did. He would go to a village, and some of the texts you'll read, he went to the villages and spent the entire afternoon and evening healing every single person who came to him. At the end of it, he was drained. He would get up early in the morning and go to a quiet place because he needed to replenish his energy. And he gave so much time to try to sort out those needs that people had. But notice, it doesn't say show mercy, it says love mercy. This is a disposition, a view of life that sees kindness as essential, vitally important. But beware, once you get into loving mercy, it's time consuming and it can be very technical. Just in this last week, I've picked up a case of a woman who tried to commit suicide the other day and was, as a result, taken into the mental health section of Newham General Hospital. And then the hospital said they were going to discharge her on Friday. She texted me because she'd been here to the food bank and said, can you do something for me? Everybody else has abandoned me. So I went to see her and they said, we're going to discharge her on Friday because this is an acute ward. We can't keep her here forever. And you could begin to see this vicious circle that once she's discharged, she will lose all hope and then she'll try and commit suicide again and then she'll be taken back in and discharged and so on, round and round the circles. And so I phoned up a friend who works in advice for people who have no recourse to public funds, and we've managed to get an appointment with Praxis, who are a specialist organisation in this, on Tuesday evening, and we need to go over there to see them. And then we've got to figure out, because now the hospital has said we'll keep her until Tuesday, but when you pick her up, that's when we discharge her. Doing some of these practical things for people can be hugely time consuming. A man came over at the end of last year from Bermuda, didn't have a penny to his name, but he did come from an overseas British territory. And so I was able to get him a national insurance number, and after that started the application for a passport. And it's tricky when you apply for a passport, because on the passport application form, it says you have to get it signed, countersigned by somebody who's known you for 2 years. But he's only been here for 4 months, so who's going to be able to do that? So I got in touch with the Bermudan consulate, and they said, but we're a British overseas territory, you should be able to do that. Get in touch with the passport office. So I got in touch with the passport office and said, if I send you a letter along with a form explaining that I've only known him for 4 months, but we've been trying to help him during that time, will that be okay? And they wrote back and said, that will be okay. And so we applied, and then I got a phone call a few weeks later saying, but you haven't known him for 2 years. And I said, indeed, I did raise this by email, and I did get an email back, which is probably sat in front of you somewhere, saying that it would be okay. He said, well, no, I'm sorry, we can't do that. No, you need to have known him for 2 years. Put the phone down. 5 minutes later, we were on holiday at the time, 5 minutes later, he phoned back and said, no, that will be okay. I said, oh, well, that's good then. And 5 minutes later, the guy phoned me up and said, I've just had a phone call from them saying I'm going to get my passport. So life turns around. The bloke came in here some months ago, hard up and working from somewhere in Eastern Europe, working, I think it was from Romania, and wanted some help. And I looked at his document, saw he was the same age as me, and I said, you're probably entitled to a 60 plus Oyster card. And so we spent that entire Friday afternoon while the lunch club was going on, going through this process online of doing it. And he went, I printed the stuff out for him, he went off to the post office. 2 weeks later, 3 weeks later, he came back brandishing a 60 plus Oyster card. He said, do you see this? Thank you so much. I said, not a problem. Glad to have been able to help. He said, now, can you get me housing benefit? And so it goes on. You're in this kind of mindset that we're actually there to help people out, and it gets technical. But you know, I didn't know any of this stuff. It's only by doing it that you learn any stuff. And I know what happens is when somebody turns up in church and they got a problem, you say, I was listening to Bruce this morning, he's got all the answers to this stuff, send him to Bruce, you know. So you come over to me and say, Bruce, this guy's got a problem, can you have a chat with him? And it mounts up. But just imagine if you could just take that idea to show kindness It may be the smallest thing, a cup of coffee, but gradually, as time goes on, you equip yourself with skills and knowledge that you can help so many people. Those who love mercy are constantly haunted by the spectre of Matthew 25. Jesus said, "I was hungry and you gave me nothing to eat, thirsty and you gave me nothing to drink. I was a stranger and you did not welcome me." When, Lord, when did we see you hungry or thirsty or a stranger? And as much as you did not do it to the least of these, you did not do it to me. The Bible carries this profound thought that the image of God is to be found in every human being. So handle everyone you meet with care. And finally, to walk humbly. I think the people who have changed our lives the most are not the philanthropists, but the scientists. I suppose there are good and bad scientists, just like there are good and bad builders and good and bad ministers. But my experience of scientists is that people who quietly get on with their research and discoveries and inventions, and then we are the beneficiaries. I know we talk about the good old days, but they weren't that good. And probably as a society, we have shifted our focus from wanting to do something to wanting to be someone. I don't need to talk to you about celebrity culture. Why do we watch Love Island? I'm not going to ask for a show of hands this morning as to who watched the program. It's just a bunch of pretty, well-toned bodies with very unremarkable brains. And that's my guess. I didn't actually watch it. But from my experience of Big Brother and all the other things that we watch, that's how it is. And yet we tune in time after time, and you're probably waiting for the next series because you can't get enough of it, and we watch it. And because we do that, there will then be another series after that and another one after that. People who want to be someone, but not people who want to do something with their lives. There was once a time in English society, and probably across the world, when if you were described as humble, you were being dismissed as an irrelevance. A humble person was someone from the lower classes with no prospect of improving their circumstances. The humble were those who were locked into lives of squalor and despair. But then, thankfully, people like Keir Hardie came along and tried to do something about it. So for those of you who are younger, do something useful with your life. By all means, try to earn enough to live comfortably, but don't seek status or the applause of others. If you walk with God, you will always be looking up at Him and not looking down on others. God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. He brings down mighty kings, sang Mary. And he raises up the lowly. In the 13th century, Richard of Chichester wrote these words: "Day by day, dear Lord, three things I pray: to see you more clearly, to love you more dearly, and follow you more nearly." He made it rhyme, which was good, but I'm not sure he improved on Micah's summary. Live justly, love mercy, walk humbly.